And welcome to this week's edition of By the Book. My name is Nachum Segal, and you're listening to the Nachum Segal Network, NachumSegal.com, JMNAM.org, and our friends at Koren Publishers give us the opportunity each week to speak with a fascinating author about a fascinating work. And Judy Klitzner is with us via telephone. She is a senior faculty member at the Pardes Institute for Jewish Studies in Jerusalem, where she's been teaching a Bible and biblical exegesis for the last two decades. A disciple of the renowned Torah teacher Nachum Leibowitz, Judy Klitzner has had a profound impact on a generation of students, many of whom now serve as teachers and heads of Jewish studies programs in the U.S., Israel, and the U.K. She is a popular international speaker who brings a dynamic, interactive teaching style to a broad and varied array of audiences. And I remind our audience that her brand new book, Subversive Sequels in the Bible, is available at a discount. Details to follow. Judy Klitzner, welcome to the Nachum Segal Network.
Thank you very much, Nachum. It's great to be here.
I appreciate that. Subversive Sequels in the Bible. If there's a way to sum it up, what is the book about?
Well, I think in order to truly understand what the book is about, you have to read the subtitle, which appears in smaller letters, How Biblical Stories Mine and Undermine Each Other. The subversive sequels I'll explain a little later. That's so that people who read this book can feel that they're doing something really dangerous. But How Biblical Stories Mine and Undermine Each Other is all about a kind of what I call a vibrant conversation that I hear that's going on between passages in the Bible. And it's gotten so bad for me that when I read a story, I can't read it without hearing echoes of other stories.
And those passages can be separated by many books and many centuries or not?
Yes, yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. They can be any parts of the Bible that can be in conversation with one another. And our tip-off as good, close readers is to listen closely, to read closely, to see if words are if stories are cross-referencing each other, if they're using similar language, if they're using similar themes. And it's our job as good readers to draw those stories together and see what the gain is, what's the payoff by looking at those stories as pairs rather than as just as individual stories.
I'm sure already some of our listeners are curious if there's a precedent for this. Is this something that you invented, or is this something that has been that has been a basic learning and therefore teaching method for a long, long time?
That's a great question. The method, I think, dates back to the ancient Midrash, that read stories and heard echoes of other stories. For instance, I'll give you an example. When Jacob accuses his father-in-law of deceiving him, he uses the words in Hebrew, "Lama rimitani," why have you deceived me?
Right.
And the Midrash says, oh, we've heard those words before. Didn't your father say about you, Jacob, Ba achicha b'mirma, said to Esav, your brother came with deceit. So there's this sense of a kind of quid pro quo that happens, and that it's through the language we're drawn back to the earlier story, and the two stories are drawn together, that somehow Jacob is getting his comeuppance. He deceived his father, and now his father-in-law deceives him. So that's the long answer to your question. I didn't invent it. I would say I maybe spiced it up a little bit. I think I expanded upon it. I've come up with examples that I believe haven't been developed before. Some of my comparisons are not immediately intuitive matches that people would think of. For instance, chapter 2, and I'll say this just to intrigue people without developing it right now, but one might ask, what does the Tower of Babel have in common with the midwives in Egypt?
Hmm.
Let's have a pregnant pause.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, let me throw out just to intrigue further. Both stories contain the words Hava and Pen. Come, let us, lest some dreaded thing happen. And those are the only two stories in the entire Bible that have those two words. Both have the words Chomer and Livanim, bricks and mortar, also the only two places where that word combination appears. And again, we have to ask ourselves, what's the point? What is the Bible trying to express by having those words appear in both of these stories? And then, of course, we look at themes that the two have in common, and both stories are enriched on the basis of the comparison.
I would guess that this is a decades-long work, meaning at the beginning of this process, I doubt you even knew there may be a book in this. But after all the after all the research, after all the thematic things you came across that fit into this whole puzzle, this whole, you know, type of picture, you felt it's book worthy.
Very, very true. Look, I have had the great privilege of teaching at the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies for many years, and this book is the fruit of a lot of thought, a lot of research, a lot of interaction with some very bright students who have certainly enriched my thinking. And at a certain point, I decided that I was going to start writing. Of course, I thought I was writing in a completely different book, but somehow this was the book that was in me, and it started gradually to present itself.
We mentioned earlier in the introduction about your association with Nechama Leibowitz, obviously a very significant name in the world of Torah scholarship. Is this project Leibowitz-like? Were you able to do this because of your a scholarship affiliation with her, or this could have been done no matter what your background was?
Most definitely. I owe a tremendous amount to my years spent studying with Nechama Leibowitz, Zichrona Livracha. She was an enormous influence in my thinking and in my life in general. I would say that certainly the literary approach that I've worked on comes from my years studying with her. She taught me and trained me to read the text very, very carefully, look for every nuance within it, read precisely, look for every nuance of grammar and syntax, word choice. She also taught me how to read the commentaries in a critical manner, to be able to ask the question, which people were not asking then, what difficulty in the verse is the commentator addressing?
Right.
And she even gave license to people to weigh the relative strengths and weaknesses of the different commentators. Who resolves the problem in the most satisfactory way? And that was, that she encouraged critical thinking and always going back to the verse itself to try to do the best reading that one could possibly do. I would say one place where I differ with her, she was very fond of saying that you can't do character analysis of biblical characters. You just can't do it. And her favorite thing to say about that was, you can't know anything about a character, biblical or otherwise, until you see how they behave online in the supermarket. And so, and the biblical text is very selective in what it presents to us.
It
tells us about the characters only in very particular situations. With all respect, I chose to not to do a little bit more than that. And I add to my analysis what I like to call a speculative layer, where using all the evidence that I find in the text to find certain possible readings of the text based on that evidence. And sometimes that leads me to character analysis with the evidence that's available, even though I never saw them online in the supermarket.
Nechama Leibowitz and the contribution that she, many contributions, of course, what you just mentioned in terms of trying to analyze the problem of the commentator and the problem that they are addressing, therefore, I would assume that she would, and many others as well, would propose that different commentators dealt with general problems in text differently than others. This sounds very Rashi-like. This sounds very Ramban-like, etc., etc., etc. They had a style just in dealing with problems that was their own.
Certainly, and that was something that she very much encouraged, was to try to begin to recognize the particular style of the different commentators, even to examine to some extent where they came from, what was their milieu, in what time period did they write, what were the social circumstances, how might those things have affected their writing, but also more than that, a general shita, like how do you say that in English? Ashita. What is their approach? What is their basic method and approach toward when they approach?
Right. And excuse the aside and the tangential mention here, and I know we're short on time, but I must ask this on that theme. Then when it comes to the examination of a commentator, she would surmise, and again, I would think others would agree, that it's impossible not to take their life conditions into account when trying to decipher their words and their comments about the text. And the reason I think that's important is because often we, often some people in scholarship and in Torah scholarship, even more so, are focused on a certain derech, a certain way, and think that it can't be influenced by outside influences. This approach would suggest, no, everyone's personal experience seeps into all of this somehow.
Certainly, and I can't imagine how it's possible for a person's life experiences not to influence their thinking. An example that she was very fond of was looking at the building of cities. The first city was built by Cain after the expulsion, after he was expelled. And there are different opinions in the commentators about whether the city is a good thing or a bad thing. So you have some commentators who are writing in an agrarian society where they talk about the city as being a terrible place. You know, it's like the destruction of all that's good because it's an anti-agrarian concept. And then you have somebody like Samson Raphael Hirsch, who's writing, you know, in the heart of the city in the Western world,
right,
talking about how that is the highest accomplishment of humanity is to be able to build cities. So he interprets that city building as something that's very positive. I don't think it's sacrilegious in any way to say that a person's personal situation is going to affect,
right,
the way that they
think. I mean, I've used this example a million times before, but I just think it's such a telling one. I believe that those who will not drink water outside of the sukkah grew up with a sukkah, you know, 4 feet away from their house, and those who would allow you, if you had a meal in front of you, to eat it if there was no sukkah around, probably grew up with a sukkah a mile away from their house. So
okay.
I just think that's always a factor. Judy Klitzner is with us via telephone. A reminder from our friends at Magid Books that if you use the code JK25 in honor of the tour that Judy is on right now, there is a 25% discount on subversive sequels in the Bible. Go to KorinPub.com. It is a Magid release. Korin Publications, of course, has Magid as one of their imprints. Subversive Sequels in the Bible is the name of the book, and I am told from my spies in Queens, New York, that your speaking tour has gone very well so far.
Ooh, you're good. Okay,
yes,
the
yes.
Long tentacles of the Nachum show. Okay.
Well, I have been told that you're quite a popular speaker. Why not mention some of the crowds that have enjoyed your speaking during this tour? Just to go through some of the chapters, because, again, some of these relationships, I guess, would be more easily understandable to the layperson than others. But you have a comparison or an insight, or, you know, you'd be better at describing what it is than I can, about Noach and Yonah. Now, we know there was a lot of water involved in both stories.
Yes.
And you earlier in this conversation pointed out how language is important, but you as a teacher must agree that, you know, there are times when there's no choice. If there's a story that involves a lot of water, there are going to be a lot of common terms that are used in these episodes. What is it about Noach and Yonah and their tales that make you feel there's a closer connection than that?
Ah, okay. First of all, I want to say that my sincere hope in writing this book was that it would be very accessible, not just to scholars, but very much to lay people. And I've been very gratified to hear from just regular people, and I have a great deal of faith in regular people. I think they are, the people that I meet in my traveling are invariably very intelligent, very enthusiastic about studying the Bible, and very capable of studying the Bible. So I think everybody can read this and appreciate it. And as to your specific question, you're right. If it were just water, I would say that's kind of weak. And I try to sound this warning for, you know, would-be parallel seekers. Don't get too excited if you find, you know, Vayomer in one story and Vayomer in another story. You know, that's nice, but let's try to deepen it a little bit. Yair Zakovich, who's a Bible scholar in Jerusalem, in the Hebrew University of Jerusalem, tells people to be careful not to indulge in what he calls parallelomania. Right? don't go overboard with it. But
we see that a lot, by the way, in the biblical codes, right, where people,
yes,
you know, and then, of course, the code experts say, you know, I could find falafel in two places of the Torah as well. Don't,
yes,
you know, so
yes,
you have to be careful how you,
right,
approach.
Proceed with caution.
Right.
So what I'm finding in the two stories, and I'm glad you brought it up, this happens to be my favorite chapter, chapter one, and I think of all the stories that I've paired together, this is the most intuitive match. To take the story of Noah and the story of Jonah, and I see this when I travel around and speak to different audiences, sometimes all I have to do is say those two words, and then I take a little rest while the room explodes with people just coming up with all kinds of comparisons.
Like I was doing in my mind.
Like you, right. You start with water, you go on to boats. You say, wait a minute, there are two sinful populations that are under threat of destruction.
Right.
Okay, so you start with the surface things. Then you start noticing deeper comparisons to be made. Like, for instance, the name Yonah, right? Jonah in Hebrew is Yonah.
And there's a Yonah. Right.
Is the dove in the story of Noah. Then you start noticing, wait a minute, and here, I'll get to that in 40 days in both stories,
right?
40 days that the warning that Jonah gives, 40 days, and Nineveh is going to be destroyed, and the flood lasts for 40 days and 40 nights. There are word names that are shared in both stories. Nineveh, which is the main, right, the two main locations in the book of Jonah, Nineveh and Tarshish, both of those appear just as at the conclusion of the flood story. There are many, the word Hamas, meaning violence,
right,
in both stories. But what you start noticing, and now I think we're ready to talk about the subversive element of my effort.
Right.
That once you draw these stories together, once you make a compelling case that they do belong together because they have so many of these elements in common, you start noticing that there's actually an inverse relationship, that the words draw them together just to show you some of the very important differences. So for instance, whereas 40 days in the book of Jonah is 40 days that are leading in the story of the flood, 40 days is the time period where there is destruction.
Right.
In the book of Jonah, 40 days is the time period that's given as an opportunity for the people to reverse themselves and reach salvation.
Mm-hmm.
The Hamas, the violence in the flood, that's the final straw. That seals the fate of the people in the flood.
Right.
You read the book of Jonah, the people give up the Hamas that they're practicing, and they're spared. The Yonah, it's another reversal. The Yonah, the bird, the dove, in the story of Noah, is a messenger. That's its job, right? Go back and go ashore and tell me bring back something, some sign that the world is inhabitable again. The irony in the book of Jonah is that here we have somebody who's called upon to be a messenger, and the first thing he does is to refuse to deliver messages. Right? He runs away from God, and the story becomes a book of God sending all kinds of messengers at the messenger. So basically, what I'm trying to get at in this reversal, in this subversion, if you will, is that you have a certain thesis that's built in the first story, where there's sin and there's inevitable punishment. There's God judges harshly. The prophet doesn't get involved to try to help the people. The people are helpless in their own fate, and everybody dies. That's a very tragic conclusion. So what we have later on is another story that picks up basically the same storyline. It says, here we've got the world in trouble again.
And look what happens.
And look what happens when God takes, instead of taking a very harshly judgmental line with the people, God takes a much more a compassionate approach and sends a prophet to try to warn them. And ultimately, God is open to the people experiencing this sense of, well, maybe something else is possible. And they reverse themselves, and that terrible fate is averted. So I, in each chapter, what I try to do is draw the stories together and then show how the second one picks up the question. And each pair raises really important questions. Another example of such a thing, you know, think of the question of theodicy, of bad things happening to good people. So you have the story of the Akedah, of Abraham being told to sacrifice his son. Nobody deserves this terrible fate, and it's ordered by God. You have later the story of Job that uses the similar language, and it's really quite striking that the names after the story of the Akedah, names like Utz, Buz, the fact that Job, like Abraham, is called Yirei Elohim, God fearing. He calls himself Afar VaEfer, dust and ashes. Right? We can't ignore these things. The two stories, and only two stories, would have all those things in common. But look at the difference then. Then the subversion of the story, where this time you have God doing something, an injustice happening to an innocent person, and this time, instead of being silent, instead of God expecting silent acceptance, this time the whole book, it's 40 chapters of the victim, of the man of faith, just spewing out everything that's on his heart and in his mind. And at the end of the book, God says, you're still my servant. You're still my faithful servant. So it takes the question of, do people have to accept this silently? And says, well, maybe in some cases, no. Maybe there's a place for protest in cases of terrible, unspeakable human suffering.
Wow, brilliant. I mean, not that you need my endorsement, but it's just brilliant.
Never hurts.
Thank you. By the way, on the Noach-Yonah comparison, back to that for a moment, no one ever recommended that the Me'ei Hadaga are the Teva of Yonah, did they? They didn't go that far, did they?
I've heard the suggestion, and I think, yes, they're both in these kind of small, confined spaces, sure. Now you're getting into it.
There's something to it, I see. Wow. And I'll tell you, when you mentioned Avraham and Eov, I was somewhat skeptical first hearing it, and then a minute later, you've brought me right into it. How the comparisons, in fact, are significant. Judy Klitzner is with us via telephone, senior faculty member at the Pardes Institute for Jewish Studies in Jerusalem, author of the book Subversive Sequels in the Bible. By the way, subversive is not the word that I question in this title. It's more sequels, because I guess you're using the word in a way to try to draw out the, you know, comparisons or thematic consistencies, but instead of using a word that would better describe those, mm-hmm. you go with sequel. Why would sequel be an appropriate way to describe these?
Well, because, Nahum, you weren't around when I was coming up with the title, so I needed help, and where were you?
Are they legitimately sequels or not? That's the question.
I think sequels is a good word, not only because of the alliteration, which generally I shy away from alliterations, but I felt that this really was the right word.
Right.
It's a story. A sequel picks up a storyline and continues it.
Right.
And what fascinates me here is that the Bible is a very dynamic book where it posits very difficult questions, attacks all the most critical issues of what it means to be human. And just when we think that we've read the entire treatment of it in one story, we realize that there's a lot more to say on it. And it really expands our ability to the range of possibilities in treating that question. Right? It's kind of revisiting certain issues and saying that ending didn't have to be the only ending to this question.
Right. And how many sequels do we know in the world of entertainment were made just because people didn't like the ending of the first one?
That's right. So here I really do see it as a book of extra chances, of people reconsidering their actions and acting differently. It's really a study of humanity, because we are, after all, people who are, you know, we're constantly learning and growing, right? In the best case, we're learning from mistakes. We're doing things differently, and I think that read this way, the Bible becomes, we are more appreciative of just how relevant it is to the human condition.
No question about it. You mentioned, I'm reading from, I believe it's the introduction, preface, chapters 4-6 examine the ever-evolving role of women in the Bible, and you mentioned at the beginning of this paragraph that when the spotlight falls on the half of humanity that is female, there's a tendency to seek a more circumscribed and uniform biblical attitude.
Yes.
Now, just is that true? Convince me of that. I'm just trying to think what you mean by that. Are we really trying to paint all women in the Bible in essentially the same vein?
Well, it depends who you mean by we.
Well, we as,
I'm not.
As,
I'm trying to unpaint them that way.
The typical Jewish world, right.
I believe, look, I have my own experience and the experience of those people I know to draw on. Certainly in my experience that was the case. I went to some very fine religious institutions and this was the way things were presented. Here are the matriarchs in the book of Genesis.
Right.
They are, and there was a list of characteristics, right? They are
beautiful.
In the background,
right.
They're silent,
right.
They are enablers, but
right.
Quietly, they're modest, they're humble, they don't speak up to their husbands, they don't speak to God, right? There's a whole list of things. Add to that the very first story of a woman in the Bible, where God says, to your husband is your desire, and he shall rule over you.
Right.
And now, in my early education, I was told that has to be... We have to find the place for the enduring truth of that statement, because, look, there it is in black and white. But if we read the Bible as a whole, if we look at that story in a context of constant literally unfolding sequels. And I look at the story of woman as kind of a sequel chain where things are constantly being re-accessed, revisited, and played out in different ways. What we see is that the story of biblical woman is very expansive, and that the possibilities of biblical woman are go far beyond that.
Right, but
what do we do with Deborah? What I'm trying to do is take a woman like Deborah,
understood,
who's a judge and a prophet, and say, well, where does she fit into your husband as your desire and
right,
your rule?
Right, but that would indicate then that. But my point being that would indicate then that when someone examines, I don't know, Miriam and Rivka, mm-hmm, they're examining the same type of personality. And I think based on the way we read about those two great Jewish women, they are so different. Or it seemed from the way you wrote this that you're suggesting that we as observers, I don't want to say scholars, I don't think all of us are scholars, but we as observers of the Bible generally put all of them in the same type of category. You just mentioned Deborah, Devorah HaNeviah. I mean, we're talking about a completely different type of personality than so many other Jewish women in the Bible.
Look, in my introduction, what I meant there was that there is a tendency to say that about biblical women.
Right.
So what you're saying is lots of people don't have that tendency, and
I'm glad to hear that. The only thing I'm suggesting that even as a kid, I never looked at Miriam the way I looked at one of the Imahot, I don't think.
Okay, but you might have looked at all of the Imahot as being
correct,
similar to one another.
Correct.
Okay, so for instance, in that case, what I try to do is show how different Rivka is from Sarah.
Right.
For instance, here Sarah is barren. She never has she never has an opportunity to converse with God. Right? Here's the conundrum.
Uh-huh.
She's barren, and we know in the Book of Bereshit what is the antidote to barrenness? It's being is God opening up the womb? Right?
Right.
It's not subtle. Right? God opens and closes wombs in the Book of Bereshit.
Correct.
Right. So Sarah is left on her own, and not only does she not pray because she can't because she doesn't have access to God, she's dependent on her husband to do that because he's the prophet in their marriage, but he doesn't speak to God on her behalf either. There's no prayer on his part for Sarah. What we see in the next generation with Yitzchak and Rivka are two very surprising things. First of all, Yitzchak prays for his wife for the first time. That a patriarch does that. But in addition, we have Rivka, who, and I argue in the book that Rivka, in many ways, is more of a patriarchal figure than she is a matriarchal figure. She's the one who is out of doors greeting guests, just as Avraham did. She's the one who she says this very, very resonant, important word, "Elech," I will go, which resonates to Lech Lecha of Avraham. Right? She and not only that, she, when she has a problem with her pregnancy, all of a sudden there's this verse that says she went to demand answers of God, and God responded to her.
A very active role.
Very active and a direct communication with God.
And even in her dealing with Brachot, it was another active role. Very, you know,
yes,
she took the bull by the horn, so to speak.
Yes. So that's what I'm looking at there, are the distinctions that they do have a lot in common.
Right.
But what's more interesting is to look at the differences and to see how dynamic is this process, and how does that dynamic process play itself out, and what does that say in the largest way about the roles, plural roles, of biblical women? Right. Really, what I want to argue is that their roles are as varied as the roles of biblical men, and people tend not to talk about what's the character of biblical men. Right. Obviously, there's every kind of biblical man that you can imagine.
Right.
But when it comes to women, for some reason, and I'll be more careful, not everybody, but a lot of people have a tendency to say biblical women are A, B, C, and D.
Oh, no, now I certainly understand better exactly what you meant. And
yeah.
And now, if I may ask you then, out of the blue, one of the most fascinating female figures in the Bible, what can you tell us about the wife of Moshe Rabbeinu? What can you tell us about Zipporah, and what observations can you make about her?
Very little.
We don't know much about her, right?
No, we really don't. We know that she appears, I mean, her one active role is in this very difficult story in the fourth chapter of the book of Shemot.
Right.
Moshe in the Malon, in this inn, where apparently God seeks to kill him, and there is an emergency circumcision that saves the day, and that is performed by Zipporah. All I can say is I'm going to punt here. I don't have a lot to say about this, but I happen to have a close personal friend whose name is Shmuel Klitzner, my husband.
I was going to say a relative.
And he has written a wonderful book called Wrestling Jacob, and he has a very wonderful, really insightful treatment of the fourth chapter of the book of Shemot. And you can't say that about a lot of people, because that is a very enigmatic story.
We know that book very well, and that is quite a work, to say the least.
Yes, yes. Yeah, I'm a fan.
A lot of great Torah scholarship in your home, huh?
We try.
Unbelievable. Judy Klitzner is with us via telephone. We have a few minutes remaining as we're talking about subversive sequels in the Bible, how biblical stories mine and undermine each other. A fascinating work, brand new from Magid Books, Koren Publications release. Go to korenpub.com, korenpub.com, K-O-R-E-N, pub.com. 25% off on subversive sequels in the Bible in celebration of the speaking tour that Judy Klitzner is on as she continues to share her thoughts and amazing scholarship with people around this country right now, and obviously always in Israel, the U.K., and many other places. So earlier in your, again, in your bio, we mentioned the Nechama Leibowitz, and one of the curiosities that we have as those who always, I never met her. So to me, she was somebody, a great Torah scholar, and somebody who was, people always spoke of her modesty, the way she carried herself, et cetera, what you'd expect from a great Jewish woman, I guess. But then again, why should we paint them all in the, with the same brush, but I think you know what I mean.
But
I'm sure there are others besides me who are listening right now who are curious about someone who had a personal relationship with her. Can you give us some insight into her as a person that made her special beyond her amazing scholarship?
Wow. Okay. Too bad we don't have more time.
Yeah, please. Take as much as you need.
Okay. First of all, I consider it a tremendous chut to have studied with her. She made Torah accessible to the masses in the 20th century.
Men and women.
Men and women. She traveled. She had enormous energy and enormous respect for every person who wanted to interact with the Bible. She traveled throughout the country. She has had so many stories about taxi drivers whom she appreciated so much. These were simple people, and she loved meeting the simple people and hearing their stories and about their connections to Tanakh, and really just...
She considered herself a simple person, right?
She considered herself a very simple person, and after she died, there were many people who told their own personal experiences with her, and one story that came up a couple of times was how all of us who knew her knew that she had her brown suit and her blue suit, and somebody dressed a brown dress and a blue dress. She was really had very minimal needs. She lived in a tiny, dark apartment with what were supposed to be two bedrooms, but she didn't use either one for a bedroom. She used one as her place for teaching everybody, where people would just cram themselves in around a table, and the walls were literally lined with either books or her Gilyonot, her life's work, her pages that she sent out to people. And the other room was used for more of that. It was all just like a place to produce all of her work. So where'd she sleep? She created this little, there was this tiny little alcove with an accordion door that you could kind of blow off. It was really just this flimsy thing.
Like a roll-top desk.
Like a roll, yeah. And she would just kind of roll herself in there at night and go to sleep, and that was it. But her needs were very humble. So she had these two dresses. At a certain point, somebody convinced her to get a third one. She bought it. And at one point, the person who convinced her to buy it asked her sometime later, well, what happened to that dress? And she said, well, somebody came by, a beggar came to the door and wanted something, and I gave her the dress. And this person, this relative, said to her, why, you gave her the new dress? And she said, why, don't you expect me to give her an old one?
Oh.
So that's one small example. But the fact that she went around, I first met Nechama, I was on a little van traveling through the Jordan Valley in 120-degree heat, and I was wilting, and she was working the crowd. She was just walking around, smoothing up all the people. There were teenagers on there that we were on our way up to a learning retreat up in Tzfat. And she also, it was for Shavuot, and she told the organizers to make sure to put her on at 3 o'clock in the morning, because she thought that people might want to stay up for her, and she, you know, they might not for some other people, so that would probably be a better way to schedule it. Okay, I don't know if you're getting a taste here, but...
I certainly am.
Yeah, also what's really important that people don't necessarily know is that she had a wonderful sense of humor, and she loved people. She just loved humanity.
Did she know languages aside from Hebrew?
She knew German. And Yiddish.
And what would she be in the internet era? I mean, she would probably be an even bigger sensation today.
Very interesting. I would think so, because she was just a great teacher, and that's in fact what she wanted on her tombstone. She wanted three words: Nechama Leibovitz Mora.
Wow.
That's teacher. That's it.
And
she didn't like technology, though. Having said that, she did not like technology. In fact, her worksheets, listen to this. What she did was she produced every week over the course of about 30 years a page of Torah learning where she would cull all the literature, all the commentary on a parasha, and ask questions on it, open-ended questions. And people, anybody in the world, was invited to read to get this worksheet, answer the questions, put it in a mailbox and send it to her, and she would correct them by hand and mail them back with her answers and comments. I mean, this is just an amazing thing. But these sheets were mimeographed, because that was a sign of the times.
Yeah.
And when many of her students begged her to try to at least, you know, maybe Xerox them or, you know, try something a little more advanced, her stock answer was, when I'm gone, or put them online. Then they wanted to put them online. She said, when I'm gone, you can do whatever you want. And in fact, that's many of her students did do that. Now her works are available online, but very true to form. She didn't want to put down answers. For her, everything was about the question, and she encouraged questioning, which also is, you know, is not a given in our. It should be. It's something I think is very central to our way of study. But sometimes we lose that ability to focus in on questions rather than just giving the answers. And she was very much in favor of putting the questions out there, getting people to find the problems in the text, and to start addressing that based on the questions that they had asked.
Judy Klitzner is with us. I know we only have a few minutes, but let me ask this about her and your analysis. If in fact we'll you know agree to the premise for a moment, that it is, or at least it was back in her day, more of a man's world. Why do you think that she made such an impact, even in the Jewish man's world, when it came to this area? And either others did not, or certainly others did not enjoy the notoriety that she had.
Right, just because she was that good. She was that good, she was that thorough, she was that scholarly, she was that accessible, she had that charisma, that sense of humor, that desire to go out to the public. That was kind of irresistible.
When you're that good, you just they can't avoid you, huh?
Yes, that's
it's
right.
As simple as that.
And she didn't want to see herself as, you know, some kind of an anomaly, you know, a woman who was doing these things. She saw herself as a human being and a scholar, and that was expected to be treated that way.
And why, when we meet people like you through this forum, and boy, do I feel privileged to meet people like you through this type of forum, we so often hear Pardes Institute. What is it about Pardes that is making such inroads when it comes to this area of Torah scholarship?
Okay, wonderful question. Look, I feel very privileged, as I said, to be part of this institution. And I think in some ways it is in the spirit of Nechama Leibovitz that Pardes is all about the question. It's about bringing in people from every possible place in the Jewish spectrum, every denomination. It's men and women. We don't impose any kind of observance on anybody. What we want are people who are open, questioning people who want to engage directly with Jewish texts. The teachers from our side don't come with an agenda of our own. We're not trying to change people. What we do find, though, is that inevitably, year after year, students are enriched by their study. They're enriched Jewishly, which is not to say that they turn from one kind of Jew into another, but whatever kind of Jew they choose to be, they are a deeper Jew in that way, and that is a very beautiful thing to watch.
Amazing. Judy Klitzner, the book is Subversive Sequels in the Bible, a unique combination of scholarship, creativity, and passion. gives her the ability to illustrate the dynamic nature of biblical attitudes toward timeless issues of self, gender, and universalism. The result is a collection of provocative original readings that will transform your understanding of the Bible. It is the winner of the National Jewish Book Award. Everyone seems to be talking about it. I'll use the last few minutes I have during the program to remind everybody how to get it. I cannot thank you enough for joining us. I know you have a very, very busy time here in the U.S. with this speaking tour. Thank you so much for joining us. Mazal tov on the book, and I hope you're getting tremendous satisfaction from the reaction out there.
Thank you. I have, and it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Judy Klitzner, thank you so much. Buy the book here with our friends at Koren Publications. The Magid Books release is entitled Subversive Sequels in the Bible. A reminder from our friends at Magid and Koren that if you order the book now in honor of the tour that is going on as we speak with Judy Klitzner here in the United States, a 25% discount on Subversive Sequels in the Bible. That is a 25% discount. Go to korenpub.com, korenpub.com. For information, and if you use the promo code JK for Judy Klitzner, JK25, you are entitled to that discount. Use the promo code JK25. And a reminder, of course, to go to the Koren Pub website for all the information about their recent releases. And this one is a Magid Books release, winner of the National Jewish Book Award. Subversive Sequels in the Bible, How Biblical Stories Mine and Undermine Each Other. And I thank all of you for listening in on another amazing edition of By the Book, brought to you by Koren Publishers here at the Nachum Segal Network. Thank you.